Good morning, all you grillers out there. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and you should be learning a lot about grilling by now. Just got through Father's Day, where all the fathers were grilling, and now we're heading towards the big grill event, which is the 4th of July.
And a big grill.
And a big grill.
A big grill with the unusual name of Meathead. And you're going to meet Meathead right now.
Oh, Meathead, we've interviewed you before and follow you faithfully. But just for those who haven't heard, can you briefly recap how you got to be such an expert on grilling? Why don't you start by telling us why you're called Meathead? Wasn't that your nickname as a kid?
It goes back to the television show Archie Bunker, way back, I guess, in the 70s somewhere.
I was there.
And Archie had a son-in-law whom he called Meathead. And my dad used to jokingly call me Meathead. And then back in the 90s or so, when I started getting involved in the internet, you had to have a handle, right? Everybody's got a handle. And so I chose Meathead. It was appropriate. I was into barbecue and grilling. Mm-hmm. And it stuck. And it became my official name.
Well, anyhow, you're great at writing, you're great at networking, and you're great at grilling, which is what we're going to talk about. We just got through one of the great grilling holidays with Father's Day, but we're coming up to an important next grilling day, which is July 1. Help us get through that.
you mean 4th of July?
Yeah, what did I say?
I thought you said July 1. That's okay. I grill
on July 4th.
I grill on July 2. I grill on July 4th.
hold on a second. I want to ask Meathead if he ever saw the show which spawned All in the Family.
I saw All in the Family. I don't know what spawned it.
There was a show on British television called Till Death Us Do Part. And there was a character.
Oh, no, never saw that one.
It was very much of a character like Archie Bunker. Except he was a dock worker in London who voted conservative. And there was a male dumbass on the show who married the Archie Bunker character's wife. I mean, they got married and they all lived together. Not very happily ever after.
A lot of the TV shows that became popular in the States had origins in the UK.
Yeah, so it was called Till Death Us Do Part, and it's worth your while to see if there isn't some place you can find it.
I'll look online, see if I can find it. But it was a very good show. I mean, it was way ahead of its time. It presaged the political divisions that are so much in the foreground now. That was back during the Vietnam War era, The country was riven also then politically by those who were referred to as the silent majority, the very pro-war, and then the anti-war audience. And it struck upon a lot of social issues, including race, religion. It was a very gutsy show, and the character...
Is he still alive, the guy who
played? Yes. The character who played Archie, I believe, is still alive, and I'm drawing a blank on the man who created the show, but he's still alive, too, and very much involved. And then, of course, the Meathead character was Rob Reiner.
Right. I forgot about that.
Right. Rob Reiner, of course, became a very highly regarded director.
Oh, yeah. Is he still alive?
Oh, yes.
Good. I just saw the Chef Peel died in California. So, but anyhow, we're back to this. You're going to give our listeners tips and ideas for cooking out on the grill for the 4th of July, including, well, I wrote cooing, it's cooking ribs and smoking meats and veggies on a grill. That's
a
lot.
Do you want to first establish who I am? Are you going to do an introduction? Or do
I thought you were going to do that. I forgot that you were going to start that. Go ahead.
Well, I'm known as Meathead because I run AmazingRibs.com, which is by far the largest barbecue and grilling website in the world. And I also have written a book called Meathead, The Science of Great Barbecue and Grilling, which is the best-selling barbecue and grilling book right now. And I'm a member of the Barbecue Hall of Fame.
Well, let's just mention that because that's a recent development. Induction into the Barbecue Hall of Fame is pretty special.
That's correct.
Congratulations
just got,
on that.
Elected to the Hall of Fame last month. There are only 25 living members. It's quite an honor. And the other guys are guys and gals are pretty cool people.
Well, the whole community of grill masters and stuff is pretty interesting. I mean, the characters are all over the place.
Yes, there are quite a few characters indeed. Now, you had asked about some tips for people who are cooking at home on their grill or their smoker out back, and there's several that I can share that I think will work for you. I want to start with the most important tool you can own to become a good cook, whether it's indoors or outdoors, and that's a digital instant read thermometer. You know, a perfectly cooked medium rare steak, and medium rare is the temperature at which steak is most tender and most juicy. And we know that because there are tools, machines that we can use to test tenderness and juiciness. So medium rare steak is 130 to 135 degrees. And that's it. It's that simple. If you have an instant read thermometer and the new digital models can give you a reading in 5 seconds or less, and you can get one for $20 to $30, you'll never overcook a steak again.
Have we ever had one that worked, Rabbit?
We don't.
Why do they not work?
No, actually, I mean, we do, but we break them frequently.
Oh. Why do we break them? That's what I don't know.
Because we do, that's all. It's just one of those things.
But in Meathead, here's something. Say you have this 4th of July party, right? And everybody has a separate degree of that they want of doneness of your steak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and how do you handle that if you're the grill master and everybody went from well done to raw?
With an instant read thermometer, it's really easy. You just poke each steak and you know the temperature range. I mean, if you've got a guide, we have one on AmazingRibs.com. You can print it out. There's one we sell that is on Amazon. But if you want somebody who wants it rare, it's 120 to 130. Medium rare, 130 to 135. Medium is 135 to 140. You either memorize or you paste this chart on your refrigerator or magnetic chart on the refrigerator, and you check each steak that way. But just as important as getting them to the proper degree of doneness, it's also an issue of safety. A few years ago, Consumer Reports purchased 300 chicken breasts and tested them all and found that 90% of them had pathogenic bacteria in them.
Yeah.
Now, that is high risk. But if you cook them to 160 to 165 degrees, you will kill all bacteria. You pasteurize them. And so now you can have a 4th of July party, and you don't have to worry about sending Granny to the emergency room. You don't want to undercook steak or ground meat. You want to get it to the right temperature as a matter of safety, not just quality. So $20 to $30, and you'll never get anyone sick, and you'll never embarrass yourself by overcooking an expensive steak. So that's where you start with a great digital instant read thermometer.
Now, can you talk a little bit for our inexperienced grillers about the resting after the cooking?
No, I don't think we need to get into that. It's a very complicated issue. And we don't have enough time. If you want, let me put it this way. There are many factors that affect moisture, and saliva is a very, very important one. And nothing gets your juices flowing like a sizzling hot piece of steak. We have tested the meat by cutting into it immediately after it comes off the grill, and 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, and there is a very slight more loss of moisture if you cut it immediately, but it's only slight, and it absorbs back up into the meat, so there's really no significant loss, and I think it's more important to serve food hot. That will get saliva flowing, and there's many other aspects to this very complicated issue.
Something that everybody gets their knickers in a knot over this resting.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah, and if you're doing chicken or turkey, while it rests, the skin is getting soft. You want crispy
skin.
Yes,
exactly.
So serve your food hot. Don't worry about resting. There's no scientific effort. There's been no research in any of the journals that I have seen. I've talked to food scientists. Nobody can prove that it is necessary.
Well, you know, I've cooked for years without knowing I should rest anything.
he's demolishing all these fond memories that I have of people who talk about reverse sear versus regular sear.
Well, now that's another topic.
Go ahead.
The time that it takes to cook something depends entirely on how thick it is. If you read a recipe that says put a steak on the grill for 6 minutes on one side, flip it over for 4 minutes on the other side, and you're done, or something like that, run. Because
it doesn't tell you how thick it is.
You don't know how thick it is. It takes longer for the heat to get to the center of a thick steak than it does a thin steak. Same thing with chicken. It takes longer for the heat to get to the center of a breast than it does to down by the bone of a drumstick. So the thickness of the meat determines how long it takes to get it done. And if you have a very thick steak, the best way to cook it is to gently warm it first so that it's even temperature throughout. And then at the end of the cook, you sear it over high temperature with the lid open so that all the power of the energy of the flame is on the underside of the steak. Then you flip it, and instead of that heat moving towards the center of the meat, it's now on top. The heat will bleed off in the atmosphere. So you'll get even color in the center and dark color on the outside. If you sear it first, then the heat will build up in the exterior and gradually move to the center, And when you're done, you'll get a dark exterior. Underneath that, you'll have a layer of brown, then a layer of tan, then a layer of pink, and then finally perfectly medium rare in the center. You get this rainbow effect. So, again, that's another myth that we're always told, is you sear it first. Whether you sear first or sear at the end depends on how thick. And my rule of thumb is if it's under an inch thick, then you just cook it over a hot flame on each side and you're done. But if it's more than an inch thick, then you start away from the heat. You divide your grill in half. Now, this is a concept called two-zone cooking, and you should do this almost every time you cook on a grill, whether it's a gas grill or charcoal grill. You turn the heat on one side. If it's a gas grill, you get one or two burners up on high, and then the other side, you leave the burners off. On a charcoal grill, you push all the charcoal to one side, and you leave the other side with no charcoal. And it's like the difference between standing outdoors on a sunny day and getting hit by infrared radiation from the sun and moving into the shade and being cool in the shade. If you think of the grill, the charcoal or the flame is emitting infrared radiation, just like the sun, and it's powerful. And you don't want to be, your meat doesn't need to, a thick piece of meat shouldn't be in the sun for a long time. It needs to start in the shade, and then you finish it on the hot side.
You know, you've proven something. I don't think grilling's as easy as everybody thinks it is. I mean, well, you're very scientific with all this.
Well, that's one of the things we've undertaken. This is the year 2021, and you know we have a great deal of sophisticated equipment out there to understand what happens to food when you apply energy to it or heat to it. The chemistry of the food changes. The physics of the whole process impacts the results. So understanding a little bit of chemistry, a little bit of physics, you don't have to make it complicated, but just understanding the core concepts is really important. Here, for example, is a good a point. Go to your kitchen and turn on the oven and set it for 200 degrees. And when it gets up to 200 degrees, stick your arm in there. You can actually do this. It won't burn your arm. You won't even singe your hair. You can hold your arm into a 200-degree oven for, you know, a minute or so. Now, take your hand and touch the side of that oven. When you get back from the hospital, you'll understand that temperature is not the same when you're measuring it in air or measuring it in metal. Metal holds and conveys more energy than air does. Both the side of that oven and the air in that oven are 200 degrees. But it doesn't hurt to hold your hand in the air, and it certainly does to touch the metal. So, I mean, it's basic physics. It's not temperature that we're worried about. It's energy. And there's more energy when you're directly above the coals than if you're off to the side. So if you divide your grill in two parts, one with lots of energy and one with no energy, you now have temperature control. It's like going from the sun to the shade, and you can cook a lot better.
Now let's pick up on one of the more challenging tasks of cooking barbecue with a different ingredient we haven't talked about yet, called fish.
Oh, fish is really a pain in the butt. but it really loves the flavor of flame. I mean, fish, grilled fish, really has a wonderful flavor, and smoke and exposure to flame really brings out a lot of the wonder in fish. The problem with fish is it's about 90% water. Steak, pork, chicken, they're about 75% water. So there's a lot of water in meat, but fish is higher in water. And it really sticks to the grill very easily. Here's a tip. you oil the food, not the grates. When you put oil on the cooking grates, it immediately changes the structure of the oil. It's called cracking. And it smokes, and the oil, well, you see that in your engine when you drive your car. You have to change that oil after a while because the heat changes the physical properties of the oil. So when you put oil on top of the cooking grates, it immediately alters the chemistry of the oil, and it loses some of its stickiness. Now, or rather, its slipperiness. Now, if you oil the food is cold. You take it out of the refrigerator, hopefully it's around 38 degrees. The food is cold. The oil is on the food. That's not going to change the temperature of the oil. You put that on the grill, and the oil will remain slippery longer, and it will prevent it from sticking. But once the food is down, once fish is down, or chicken is another problem, don't touch it. You can try gently to lift it after 4 or 5 minutes, and if it's still sticking, leave it alone. It'll eventually let go. Now, if you've got a piece of fish say you're cooking a very delicate white fish or something, and it tends to stick a lot, the really cool way to help prevent it from sticking is to coat it with mayonnaise. Mayonnaise is mostly oil, but it is a suspension of oil with other ingredients, and it's very slippery. And when you use mayonnaise instead of oil, it will be more slippery than with oil. And the mayonnaise actually doesn't really flavor it much. Most of it melts and drips off. So mayonnaise is a good way to coat fish.
Good. Now, everybody's hot to do veggies on the grill nowadays because we get more books on vegetarianness and vegan that than we ever have ever. And cook them on a grill is... We always did that. My favorite way to eat okra is grilled on a grill.
Of course, most people fry it, but it's really good grilled.
Yeah, if you're watching your fast and stuff, it's a great solution, I think. I mean, it's still oil.
The problem with a lot of vegetables is that they're small enough and they fall through the cracks of the grate.
So then you have to have something, a plate on it.
Yeah, they sell gadgets called grill toppers, and basically it's just a piece of metal with holes cut in it. But the holes are small enough so that you can cook things like cherry tomatoes or nuts, peas, and they don't fall through. Onion slices.
You smoke peas? I can't imagine why you smoke peas.
We grow sugar snaps. My wife's a master gardener, and I'm in the Chicago area, and come July and August, that we'll go many, many nights without meat, not when the garden is putting out. But a grill topper is a great way to keep small objects from falling through.
This is also true with some fish, like plankton.
Yes.
Blank sailor.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, you list as one of your specialties smoking meats and veggies on a grill. How do you change it into a smoker, or do you just use the smoker?
Of course, if you have a dedicated smoker, that's really great because it's designed to do that. But you can make any grill into a smoker. And the best way is set it up in two zones, just like I described before. All the heat is on one side, no heat on the other side. And then let's say you're doing a slab of ribs. 4th of July for me is ribs.
I need a lot of information on ribs. There's a lot of misinformation out there, but finish with this, what you're talking about.
Well, 4th of July is a great opportunity to cook ribs, and what you would do is divide the grill in half and you've got all the heat on one side and no heat on the other side, and you put the meat, the ribs, on the side without heat, and then you throw wood on the flame and throw a good bit there, a handful or two of wood chunks or chips or pellets or sawdust. You want to use a hardwood, and you don't need to soak it. Soaking wood doesn't work. First of all, wood doesn't absorb water.
See, that's some sort of heresy that I've read, that you have to soak the wood, and you're telling me no?
No, all the books tell you to soak the wood. Guess what? There's a reason they build boats out of wood, because wood doesn't absorb water. We've done the tests. I've taken wood chunks, wood chips, weighed them, soaked them overnight, not just an hour or two like the books say. You soak them overnight, shake off the water, weigh them again, and they gain about 3 to 5%. And it's all right on the surface where the wood is fuzzy. And when you throw that on a hot flame, what's the first thing that happens? It steams. It boils the water off. The water all comes off, and that happens at 212 degrees. But the wood doesn't ignite. It doesn't become smoke until 500 degrees. So you go from steam, and then you got to wait around until it goes up 300 degrees and catches on fire. So all that stuff that you see when you throw wet wood on the charcoal or the flame is steam. It's not smoke. So throw dry wood on the flame side of the grill, and it will smoke, and that smoke will circulate under the hood to the other side where the ribs are, and they will gently cook by convection airflow. You want to shoot for around 225-degree air temperature on the indirect side. And baby back ribs will take maybe 3 to 4 hours, and spare ribs or St. Louis cut, which is a variation on spare ribs, they'll take about 5 to 6 hours if your air temp is about 225 on the indirect or the side without heat.
You know, I had a slab of baby lamb ribs from Jamison Farm. You probably know them. It's our local organic lamb farm. But at any rate, I've never cooked baby lamb ribs before.
Yeah, they're hard.
Yeah, and I looked up on the Internet recipes for this, and the timing on these things ranged from an hour to 6 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on how thickness and what temperature you're cooking at. Lamb ribs, if you think of a rack of lamb, you get they're typically 8 in a rack. Pork ribs are 12 or 13, depending on how they're cut. Beef ribs are 7 to 8. Lamb ribs are usually 8 in a rack, but there's not much meat on them. And
there's
most
no meat
of the time,
at all.
It depends on how they're butchered. Sometimes they can leave a lot of meat on. Sometimes they can take the meat off. It really varies. And also the amount of fat. Pork fat and beef fat are kind of tasty, but lamb fat is kind of weird. It's not everybody's favorite fat. Lamb ribs are tricky, and it really depends on how your butcher has cut them.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, your book, does it give all these clues? Is this about?
The book is divided in two parts, and the first part is all science and technique and concepts, and it's like a textbook. And the second half are the recipes that apply all the concepts from the first half.
We interviewed you about, right?
Yeah. If you look on Amazon, it's got a solid 5-star rating. Absolutely love it.
I think we really better get that on on our announcement of this program so that people can really study this. It's a lot to know and a lot to learn before the 4th of July.
Well, we have AmazingRibs.com. The website has over 2,000 pages of information. A lot of what's in the book is on the website. The problem is you know how the Internet works. You can go to my recipe for last meal ribs. They're so good that if you're on death row, you'll ask for the last meal ribs for your last meal. And you can go to that recipe, and it's there. And but then it'll say, okay, now click here to learn how to set up a gas grill. Click here to learn how to set up a charcoal grill. Click here to learn how to do it on a smoker. So off you go in 16 different directions, and you get down into this rabbit hole. But a book has the beauty of a beginning and a middle and an end. And I wrote it so that it will hold your hand and take you through the process step by step. Without hyperlinks jumping around. So books are a better way to learn, but there's all this information is on the website, and that's free.
Okay. Well, you are a wonder, and I'm not surprised that you're in the Hall of Fame.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. It's so good talking to you all the time. And
it's my
pleasure. It's wonderful talking to somebody who knows exactly what they're doing. A lot of people we've learned.
The first step is go out there and look at that grill and say to yourself, I'm smarter than you. And once you figure out how it works and get a few basic techniques like two-zone cooking, using a thermometer, you can master the grill. You can become great at smoking. You can just cook anything you cook indoors, you can cook outdoors only better.
You're talking to Peter Haig, who actually cooked an entire goose on the grill for Christmas.
Good for him. Good for him.
It was so delicious. Did a lot of work. So, anyhow, Meathead, you are wonderful, and I'm glad to talk to you again.
Thank you.
And keep up the good work.
Thank you. Do the same.
Yeah, all right.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we've got Mike Lang, whose book has the evocative title of One Beer Growing. Figure that out, but meanwhile, he'll tell you about it.
There we go.
Yeah, well, perfect timing of the year to have this book come out, Mike Lang, One Beer Growing. Fast, easy, and French recipes, American. Fresh recipes for great grilled meals that you can make before you finish your first cold one. So if you wanted to know, listeners, what the title really means, it's one beer is all before you can finish your grilling. That's not altogether true with all of your recipes.
You can get it done within a one-minute time frame, which is quite remarkable. Let's do that just for our Pittsburgh listeners. You're probably recognizing Mike Lang's name and thinking that he's the commentator for the Pittsburgh Penguin hockey team, who had all kinds of wonderful little sayings, including, Elvis has just left the building. Well, in this case, Elvis has just joined the building. So welcome to us all the way from Dayton, Ohio.
Thank you so much. By career, actually, as I am a police sergeant here in Southwest Ohio.
Yeah. And but you've done a lot of grilling. In your book, you say that you have 20 grills in your backyard.
I do, between the backyard and a few tucked away for safekeeping in the garage. Got a little bit of everything depending upon what I'm doing, and certainly my work with Weber Grills has facilitated a lot of that.
Let's get that one up right front here, listeners. You have to understand that Mike is a spokesperson for Weber Grills, which I don't mind saying we've always used Weber Grill anyhow, but I thought we should say that up front.
yes, for sure.
Okay. Okay,
and
so
you have every model they ever made, I guess, right?
Just about, yes, I do. Depending on what I'm doing, I need the current model to shoot on or to do video work with, so that is a requirement.
Now, you have both charcoal ones and gas ones?
Yeah, charcoal, gas, and even a pellet grill, which is one of their newest additions, the smoke fire.
Yeah, you mentioned that, and I just figured out that it's probably a grill where you use those pellets in.
Yes, it is.
Now, what's a pellet grill? I didn't read about that one.
Pellet. It's basically an electronic grill that takes pulverized wood pellets into like almost like capsule form, and then uses that as the fuel source. It's a great grill from the standpoint of you basically set a temperature like an oven. And the grill has the intelligence to keep it at that temperature in that range. Plus, you get a wonderful wood smoky flavor profile out of it as well, with a lot less work.
Okay, all right. So it's really a next generation grill.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Probably in the market.
Have you tried that Green Egg? I see that.
Yeah, actually, I had a Kamado grill from a different manufacturer for quite a while, but then I moved with my Weber grills to what they've caught is basically a version of a Kamado grill, but instead of ceramic, it's double-walled stainless steel, air-insulated, and they are wonderful grills. Unlike the ceramic grill, when it falls over, it's probably not going to shatter into a million pieces, but it can just as well hold temperature for almost 24 hours.
Oh, wow.
You know, I mean, I think I'm a Luddite because, I mean, I have so much kitchen equipment that people have sent me, and I can't figure out how to use it. It's like having to start learning how to cook all over again.
There's definitely a learning curve.
We need you to come for a visit, Mike.
Well, I would love that. You let me know.
we'll send you a ticket and... Come on over and tell us all about how to make it work.
And remind me, where are you guys located again?
We're in Pittsburgh.
Right? Okay, great. Not that far away.
Yeah. Not too far away.
And I'm a grill freak, too. In fact, funny story, I guess, that I'll keep relatively brief, but there was a period of time when Anne was confined to a hospital bed on the first floor of her house because she'd had surgery. And I had to cook everything, but I don't know how to cook on a stove, on a range. I didn't know how to do that. So I used to cook all the protein and that kind of stuff on the Weber grill outside the back door. And then I would cook the vegetables on the range. And I would bolt back and forth between the two cooking stations.
Well, you did a lot of the veggies on the grill, too.
Well, that was later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest threat to the neighborhood was when he decided to do a Christmas goose on the grill.
Oh my gosh! But that was fantastic.
It was, but I had to. I got a Chinese steamer, and I got a lot of the fat out of the goose before we put it on the grill because I didn't want to incinerate the whole neighborhood.
That could be a bad side effect.
But the major downside of that was that what I had paid $4 or $5 a pound for in a fine Canadian goose, I saw melting away. So the goose got to about two-thirds of the size at which it started.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so, what's probably your favorite thing to grill, Peter?
What's that?
What's your favorite thing to grill?
Probably leg of lamb, I think, probably.
Huh? Yeah, that was good.
Because that was the first serious thing that I attempted. And my wife had... We always loved lamb. We had a lamb supplier who used to send us two lambs a year, and we would cook the legs in particular, all spiced up and all that kind of stuff in the oven. And the day after, the day I'm going to tell you what happened, was Anne's birthday.
Mm.
And I had this brainwave that I would go to the store that was kind of like Walmart,
mm-hmm.
and see if I couldn't buy a grill, a charcoal grill, and then I would cook a leg of lamb for Anne on her birthday.
No.
On the kettle grill. And it worked, and it became my signature dish.
Oh,
and there was a queue formed down the street for people who were going to be honored enough to actually come and taste it. Because
my favorite thing was that we had these friends over all the time for years for this famous leg of lamb. And it wasn't until, after we'd been doing it and having them over for about 8 years, did the male of this couple tell us that he hated lamb.
Oh, no.
So, he ate it too.
So we didn't serve it for him anymore.
back to this book.
Yeah.
You really, you go to just about anything and cook it on the grill. I mean, you think just about anything could be, but you really like planking.
Yes. Yeah, so I mean,
that's one thing that Peter's never done much.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, and it's so easily inaccessible. I'm a big adage, too, and kind of like Peter's story of taking everything outside. I mean, anything you cook in the kitchen, you can cook on the grill. The grill can be a stovetop, a range. It can be an oven. And planking is a great way, I've found, of adding more flavor to food through a smoldering plank, depending upon the wood species. But it also makes it easier for a beginner griller because it gives you some time that you're not going to burn everything. So if you're cooking,
yeah, I still have a plank that we've never used that came with a smoked salmon that we bought.
Yeah,
and we
and that's a great example.
Yeah.
I mean, for people that are afraid of, you know, if I cook a salmon fillet in a grill and it's going to stick, well, it could happen, but if you put it on a plank, it's not going to stick. It's going to taste fantastic, and it's a really easy process to cook.
Is that right? No, because I read that section of your book very, very carefully because planking was something I have never tried, and I need a mentor to teach me. How to really do it, but it's all right do you soak the plank? So that it's
you don't want to burn it.
Flame inhibited.
Yeah, you can, about 30 minutes usually. Now, sometimes, though, too, if I know I'm going to be by the grill, I might not because I really want that plank to smolder over the briquettes and put off more smoke. So you can skip that step. And you can also, depending on how much you use it, reuse the planks two or three times.
You can do that, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Now, I will tell you my favorite grilling toy.
The chimney.
It's not a charcoal chimney. Although charcoal chimneys are pretty important. No, this is the beer can chicken machine.
You have
a beer can chicken recipe. Not surprisingly,
I do.
Because everyone has one of those.
Yes.
But we actually have a device, an assembly, I guess you would call it, that doesn't use a beer can.
Mm-hmm.
It has a prong, if you like.
It's a manufactured.
It goes up inside the bird.
Yeah.
And it has a reservoir in the bottom where you put the beer, and when the beer starts to become not liquid anymore, but smoke.
Yeah, it's steam. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not steaming. The steam goes up this chimney, and then comes down the other side, and it gives the most incredible tender. Mm. I mean, you said beer can chicken is very tender, and I'll tell you, my beer can chicken machine is the ultimate tender.
Well, it sounds like it.
And Mike, I have to say that the parts of me reading this book is reminded of the saying that if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I mean, do you always think in terms of how to do whatever it is on the grill?
Sadly, yes.
I mean, anyway. I'm looking now at your planked, twice-baked mashed potatoes.
Yes.
And it seems a very unlikely candidate for a grill to me.
Yeah, and that's one of those things. I don't even remember how that idea came to be. I know I love a good spud. And I was like, you know what, those should belong on a plank. And they're amazing. And it's, yeah, I love to incorporate those things in the grill that you would not normally think of.
Now, Hasselback potatoes is another one. I saw somebody cooking Hasselback potatoes just the other day, and I saw you had a recipe for that.
Yeah,
of course you have a recipe for that. You have a recipe for everything.
Or at least 75 of them.
Well, you know, the other thing is I think I completely forgot about this particular dish item until I read the recipe in your book, Monte Cristo sandwiches.
Oh, yes.
Mm. I forgot about those. They used to be very popular, right?
They did.
When was
I remember, that? You said why or when?
When?
I remember it's probably more, I think, in the early 2000s. At least I remember around here in Ohio, every place had like a Monte Cristo on the menu. I don't know if they went out of fad or what, but a few places, more probably artisan places, you see them pop up now. But most,
yeah,
you know, mainstream restaurants would have them. I would gorge myself.
I think of them more like my school days or something.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I think they were popular then. They're very good. Made me hungry.
Oh, my gosh, yes. It's got kind of savory, sweet treat. I'm a sucker for it.
Well, didn't we make Reubens on that thing we had that's like a George Foreman, except it's not a George Foreman?
I don't remember. I mean,
It's like a cooking sheet, almost.
Well,
you must have one of
is.
Those.
Kind of like you're making like a panini or something like that, like a press?
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Did we have one of those? I can't
we do. Yeah, you call it like a panini press.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
For the grill, you can just take a brick and wrap it in aluminum foil, and it's a very low-tech, but works just as well.
Well, my cousin, who was once married to a Cuban, he did his Cuban pressed sandwich with the brick when he was visiting us. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds good.
That was good. Yeah. So what do you do with? I mean, do you test all the grills? Is that what you do?
Usually, as far as for Weber, I'm using those grills to create content for them. So a lot of my photos will appear on their social channels and their website, not only here in the States but worldwide.
Really? No, you did the photography, too.
Yes, and the cookbook, yes. All those pictures are mine. Oh, thank you. I'm merging my love of photography and grilling. It's a wonderful combination because, you know, as you guys know above anybody, food and visually food is an international language, and it's wonderful.
Right.
In fact, I've got a friend in Normandy, France, that is a diehard Weber griller. He doesn't speak a lick of English. I don't speak any French, but we use Google Translate and share photographs and our grilling back and forth, and it's an amazing way to communicate, and food makes it so much easier.
Now, so I'm looking at the picture of your beer brats. It's a great photo.
Thank you.
Let's come back to that. I want to come back to the beer because the beer is a very important part of the book because it's in the title. But,
yes.
I wanted to mention and get your opinion on the advantages of charcoal rails. That was the thing that made it possible for me to cook legs of lamb for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Was being able to have a cool spot in the middle of the grill.
Oh, yeah, you're different.
This is a way of separating your grill into zones for indirect heat.
Exactly.
Where there's no heat source beneath the protein or direct heat where there is a heat source below the protein.
That's it, exactly. And I'm sure you must you must use that kind of thing yourself.
Oh, for sure.
Do you have any more gadgets like that?
That's probably one of the most important things is being able to split apart your briquettes and also a way of moving them. I've got like a charcoal rake that makes it a lot easier and safer to move briquettes around the grill. You know, you figure the average griller, they just think of charcoal and direct heat, but your grill and your kettle grill especially becomes so much more versatile, especially like with your rack of lamb. We start cooking things not on the heat, or better yet, have a safe place for that large steak to go to. If it starts to flare up and cook too fast, you can take it off the heat and move it to indirect, and it makes it for a really successful grilling experience.
Yeah, it really does. It makes a charcoal grill behave more like a gas grill.
Yeah, completely.
In terms of the control that you have of the environment in which you're cooking.
Yeah, I mean, my two favorite tools, funny enough, are going to be a timer and a thermometer.
Yeah, you said that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, especially for me, I'm always being distracted by something. So that timer keeps me focused as far as getting into the zone when I know my meal's going to be done. And then that temperature probe, it's important to check that protein, whether it be a steak or be fish or chicken, to make sure you're cooking it to just the right temperature and not too far over and certainly not under. And that can make anybody successful at it.
Talk a little bit for our listeners who probably blanched at the idea that I blanched at the first time I tried, which is cooking fish on a Weber grill.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself all the way through the buying of the fish and the prepping of the grill and the putting the fish on the grill and thinking, oh my God, what if I ruin this halibut which I just paid $2.50 a pound for?
Oh yeah. It can be a little daunting.
I was very nervous.
Yeah, I mean, cooking fish can always be a challenge. The biggest way to be successful is, number one, to make sure your grates are clean. Get a grill brush, scrub them clean, get off any debris. Then it's very important to not oil the grates, but you want to actually oil the fish with olive oil, lightly brush it on there. When the fish goes to the grill, that first side is going to cook longer than the second side. The grill is going to release it when it's done. So if you feel resistance when you go to flip it, let it ride out another minute and a half. The grill's going to know when it's done, and then it will release, flip it. The second side won't cook as long because you had the first one on longer, and then you should be able to pull it off with that piece of fillet relatively all intact.
Yeah, I still have a sheet. I guess I call it a barbecue sheet, but it's just a metal sheet, and it actually has holes in it as well. And I bought it at Home Depot.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad does the same thing.
He'll use it.
And, you know, the safest, if you really want to try fish, you haven't done it, I recommend get a salmon fillets, skin on, cook that over indirect heat, 350 to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and don't worry about flipping it. Just let it cook as is. You're basically roasting it. And then when you're done, put that spatula between the flesh and the skin, scoop it right off, and you're going to have a perfectly cooked piece of fish on the grill.
Yeah, I peel the skin off. This is doing it in the kitchen instead of on the grill. I could do the same on the grill in the garden as well.
Yeah, but absolutely.
I put the fish on skin side down. No, skin side up for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then peel the skin. And then I save the skin, and it's my treat. and I return that skin to the oven to crisp up after I've served the salmon.
I bet that's delicious.
And that's exactly what we're having for dinner tonight, love, right?
Oh, nice. That's a good segue.
Exactly. We're having Norwegian salmon, and we will be cooking it and preparing it just exactly the way I just described.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, Mike, how does the average person, I mean, you know it just by experience, how does the average person know when to move from the hot zone to the cooler zone when they're cooking?
Yeah, it's like let's use a large steak, for example. If you, let's say, already flipped it and you're trying to finish the cook and the fat's starting to render so much that you're getting a lot of flare-ups, you'll see active flame above the grates. that's probably a really good time to move it to a cooler spot of the grill. Let it cool down a little bit. Don't want to burn the flesh on the outside, and you still want to keep on cooking. That's probably the best visual indicator. You know, it's that gut punch. You're like, it's got a lot of flame going on there. That's when you want to move in, get it off those coals, put it someplace cooler, but let it finish cooking.
Is there anything that you have not been able to figure out how to cook on the grill?
No, but when I do, I'll let you know. You know, the weirdest thing I've ever cooked on the grill is a hog's stomach.
Oh, no.
It's basically, it's a vessel for other things. In this case, I stuffed it full of vegetables and potatoes. It's a very old world sort of preparation. Not say it wasn't the greatest. I mean, I pulled it off, but I've never done it again since. If that gives you any indication what I thought about it. But it's a challenge to find new things and keep things fresh, and that's what I love to keep on doing.
It's kind of like...
I mean, like, why would you want to cook macaroni and cheese on the grill?
Because the grill is going to put off an extra layer of smoky goodness that you would not normally get if you made those things on a stovetop.
There you go.
If you like that flavor profile, like if you like an Islay scotch, or you like some true Texas barbecue and you want to have those things in other sorts of dishes you might not think about, then put those things on the grill.
You know, we interviewed somebody, and I can't remember I know what it was. It's the origins of Southern African cooking, the Gula cooking, and his recipe for collard greens. And I said, I always thought you had to put a smoked ham hock in there to cook the collard greens. He said, no, his recipe calls for pimenton, the smoked paprika, and that does it. And I tried it, and I did not need to have to add the ham bone.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. So pimenton is a good thing.
Oh, yeah, it's great. You just never know.
Yeah, and a last thing here for you is I want you to tell our listeners about a fatty.
About a what?
A fatty.
Oh, a fatty. A fatty is a classic barbecue staple. It's basically a pound of pork sausage. It has been seasoned. It's stuffed with cheese and really whatever. In my case, in the book, it's stuffed with hard-boiled eggs. It's then wrapped in a weave of bacon, and then it's smoked on the grill. And it is literally to die for.
That might be the outcome if you're not careful.
it may very well be.
Now, there's one less value proposition that's in this book.
Yes.
Remember, the title is all about beer. And guess what? On every page, with every recipe, is a beer recommendation. And I can only suggest, since I've drunk many of the ones you recommend, that you should dedicate at least a part of your lifetime to drinking one each of all the beers in the book.
I could not agree more with you.
And you probably have already.
I think just about, yes. What's that about?
Well, Mike, is this your first book?
It is. Yes, it is. It just,
I'm hoping it won't be your last, because you have a great creative fervor for grilling.
it's a wonderful passion of mine. It's worked out great to keep me sane through all these years, so I couldn't be more happy to share it with you guys.
Great.
Well, thank you.
Again, listeners, it's called One Beer Grilling, and the author is Mike Lang. And I hope you get to retire and visit your friend in France.
Yes, it's on my list. And Ann and Peter, thanks so much. You've been wonderful hosts. I've truly enjoyed this.
Well, we did too, Mike, and we're enjoying the book. Thank you.
Well, that's another wrap for this week. Again, have a happy and wonderful 4th of July. And we're getting fireworks back again this year. But same time, same place next week. We'll see you then. And in the meantime, bye-bye.